It's the Talking Elephant edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Elephant Speak, 100 Years to Alpha Centauri. Does the Earth have astrocene? And what do we know about rent-a-cops? Let's begin episode 188.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your philosopher political scientist. Ethan, you know, we had a great time this weekend at Skeptic Camp, but I want to start the show off with a bit of a trivia question, because everyone knows that for political pundits and such, this is sort of the Super Bowl of politics. So, when is the President of the United States being elected?
The President of the United States?
Yes. When president. Do they have their election for the President?
Well, I believe this year it's today.
That's what most people would think. But actually, no. The actual election of the President is December 17th. Today is the day where they elect the electors, where they have this antiquated system where you can't really trust the people with voting for president, but you can trust respectable people to vote in their stead. And you know, a lot of people think, hey, it's the election today, but it's not. Nerd fact for the day. Speaking of nerd facts, Ethan, did you pick up any nerd facts at the wonderful Skeptic Camp they had this Saturday?
Well, speaking of nerd facts, I mean, Skeptic Camp is the place to go for nerd facts. And we have a lot of nerd facts to discuss. I mean, Skeptic Camp, of course, is the grassroots, community-organized, non-conference conference for skepticism, where local amateur skeptics get together and give talks on various things that interest them. This year, we had a really great selection. We had speakers who were talking about vaccines and how they were made. We discussed, did Shakespeare really do Shakespeare? And among other things such as that. And it was just a really fantastic day. I had a great time. Did you have a good time, Don?
I had a very, very good time. And I must admit, I was not expecting the fact that Shakespeare actually was an alien. I mean, of all the things that came out, that struck me. I mean, everyone knows Aristotle was an alien, but Shakespeare, no, actually it was quite fun. And actually, I think one of the things that comes out of the Skeptic Camp that people don't think about is not only is it an opportunity for the skeptic community to kind of come together and, you know, have a certain degree of solidarity, an opportunity for us to learn a little bit about a wide and diverse variety of topics, but it also provides sort of a training ground for skeptics to learn how to talk in front of a group of people. One of the things that we often emphasize on this particular show ourselves is the need for scientists and skeptics to learn how to communicate with a wider populace. And granted, this might not be considered to be a wider populace, but I noted a number of speakers went up there, they gave their talk, and one of the things that they were learning was, how do I respond to questions? How do I keep the audience engaged? How do I keep it interesting? And so, I mean, it was a learn opportunity, situation.
Yeah, that's the great thing about Skeptic Camp. You know, if you go to a big conference like a TAM or a SciCon, you see professional speakers. And while we do have professional skeptics, if I can use that term, a lot of the speakers were students or just local activists or people who just had a big interest in whatever it is they were talking about. And, you know, it was really great. I mean, some of the topics, for example, a friend of the show, Dave Hutchinson, gave a talk on cannabis for curative medical purposes. Really fascinating conversation.
And I love the fact he gave out samples.
Yeah, that was potentially illegal. No, I'm just kidding. He did not do that. Of course not. But we had, for example, Pat O'Brien, Dale Beierstein, two local skeptics, gave a talk about Paul Kurtz and told some stories. They had known Kurtz because they were involved with the humanist movement in the past. We had talks on political bias, reverse engineering vaccines, telling the difference between a skeptic and a true believer, and among other things. So a really great sampling of all the different talking points that we have in our larger movement.
You know, and actually it was the talk about the difference between a skeptic and a true believer that Dale Bernstein, I believe, gave. He had the one quote that I loved, and I forget who he said it came from. He says, I've never met anyone so stupid that I couldn't learn from.
Yeah.
You know, with the idea that, you know, even when you sort of tilt at windmills, right? So, you know, we sit there and we may debate a creationist or some other sort of quote-unquote crazy person from our perspective. Not only does it provide us an opportunity to sort of, you know, hone our skills, but skeptics should always be questioning their own beliefs, and they should always be making sure that they're coming at them honest. In fact, I think, what was it, two episodes ago, the cellular memory, where, you know, I just assumed it was X, and I actually had to go back and do a bit more research because someone had said, hey, maybe you've got that slightly off. For the record, I was right, but yeah, I had to reevaluate my judgment.
Yeah, and that's a great point because, you know, we often get, I think, bogged down discussing what our purpose is, what our grand design is for debating somebody, whether we're trying to convince them, whether we're trying to convince an audience, or whether we're just trying to hone our skills. And I think that it speaks to the fact that it's a multi-pronged approach. We shouldn't expect there to be one answer and one answer only. We are constantly going to be learning in our movement. And that's, I think, our great strength, is that we're not, you know, married to our belief. We're not dogmatically going to support, for the lack of a better term, let's say evolution. We're not going to dogmatically say evolution is true, always will be, never will change. We're willing to entertain new ideas. And in fact, you know, the evolution that Charles Darwin talked about is pretty different from the evolution that we have today that we understand. And I think that that speaks to the skeptic's ability to take in new information, evaluate it, and change our mind.
Well, it's all a part, again, you know, we had talked about the true Scotsman fallacy about, you know, what is a real skeptic versus a not. And I think one of the things that is definitive of it is the idea of the scientific method, and only because it is, to this point, the best and really the only way we've discovered of a self-correcting ideology. So there isn't a dogma in it other than the fact that whatever you believe may change based upon the facts that you know. And that's one of our strengths. And sometimes we forget, you know, sometimes we kind of rest on what we knew as opposed to what has changed since we learned that.
Yeah, which is a good lesson that's going through the skeptical movement right now, not to rest on our laurels, but actually press onward and address new controversies.
And speaking of pressing onward and new controversies.
Yes. Oh,
in
boy.
In the nerd news.
Big, big news.
Yes.
So the reign of a tyrannical dictator has come to an end, and the reign of a brand new tyrannical dictator has been taken up. That is, Disney has bought Star Wars. In fact, Disney has purchased Lucasfilm, the company that George Lucas started and dictated, for something around $4 billion and change.
Well, you know, I understand George was coming, you know, he's getting a little short of change, and you know, he wasn't able to afford, you know, the bottle of Coke he likes every day. So he thought, well, I'll sell some of my assets. And $4 billion, I'm sure, will help him, you know, buy that new fridge he wanted or what have you.
Well, apparently, I've actually heard that he plans to donate a large portion of that to charity.
Well, I give him kudos for that, and yeah. I apologize for my slight insult.
Well, given the fact that he, you know, kind of destroyed millions of people's childhood by with Jar Jar Binks, it is kind of fair.
Actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned that particular part. I was listening to a bunch of podcasts about this in the cultural significance of Star Wars, and hey, they are a spoiler, I guess, alert, sort of, that there is plans now for a third trilogy, which is why often people complain about him talking about this number 7 in the trilogy, but the trilogy is a trilogy of trilogies, so it makes some sense. But anyhow, about number 7 coming out, right? Mm-hmm. And how, you know, what that's going to be doing. But one of the things I thought was ironic is that George Lucas saved the last trilogy by so screwing up the second trilogy that, you know, to be fair, anything that came after the first three movies could not really have lived up that up. If only because culture and society and the way we view things has changed so much, you could never have that sort of cathartic landmark thing. So the fact that the next three trilogies, the prequels, were so bad means really anything they make now is going to seem better. It's going to be, okay, you know, it's still not the first three, but we feel so much better about the Star Wars franchise.
Well, the great thing about this that I like, and I know that there are some fans who are rejoicing and some fans who are going, oh, Disney, oh no. But this actually gives us skeptics an interesting opportunity, because the reigning hypothesis is that the reason the prequel trilogy was so bad was that George Lucas had sort of absolute control over it. And the reason that the original trilogy was so good was that Lucas was a new director. They really didn't give him any control. And, you know, Empire Strikes Back was directed by a seasoned director. And Return of the Jedi, which is kind of the odd movie of that, that it was sort of half good, half bad, was sort of George sort of did both directing, but also kind of hands off. So this litmus test is that removing George Lucas from the equation, does Star Wars get better? So we have a testable hypothesis here. You see where I'm going with this? You see this?
Yeah, no. I see it. See, you know, always good to have that skeptical mind. But of course, don't you find that ironic that George Lucas, who created Star Wars, you're essentially saying that the only way Star Wars can be good is if the guy who actually created it has nothing to do with it.
Well, here's the thing that I've always said about George Lucas. He is a good storyteller, but he's a bad writer. He came up with a good idea, but he's not good at translating that idea to paper. So we'll have to see. I don't know. Maybe it'll suck. But no, hey, The Avengers was good.
I think that's a great thing. And in fact, on that note, maybe we're going to take a bit of a break. And when we come back, we'll have a bit more of In a Land Far, Far Away, Deep in Space.
Absolutely.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The rhythm section.
This October in Discorder, get the scoop on Vancouver drone pop artist White Poppy, have a chat with comedian and host of Talent Time at the Biltmore, Paul Anthony, and learn more about the local pop band Fine Times. Reminisce with them as the magazine takes you on a blast from Discorder past, discussing censorship, the CRTC, the PMRC, Public Enemy, and Ice-T, the original gangster. Then, pack your bags as they take you on a quick trip to the East Coast to follow Halifax band Nick Everett and Everybody. Look out for the art feature, recapping Swarm and the Oleo Festival, the news on West End DIY Space, Googly Eyes Studios, and Film Strip with Cartoon College, as there will be an interview featuring Jason Zampano, one of Vancouver's own, who scored the film. As always, there will be heaps of album and concert reviews. So pick up your free copy of the Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or check out discorder.ca if you're going green. Discorder, that magazine from CITR supporting local music for over 25 years.
And we're back. So, Star Wars, going to outer space and traveling. There's a thing, a symposium that was on just recently called the 100 Year Spaceship Symposium, which is part of the 100 Year Spaceship Project. Well, it's not so much a project, but more of a project to create a plan, to create a project, to travel to another star in about 100 years. And by 100 years, it's a little fuzzy whether they mean in 100 years they plan to launch, or when they launch, it will take 100 years to get to the star based on some of the technology. That's who knows. This is a year-long project that will bring together the world's leading intellects in space technology to hammer out the viability to plan, design, construct, and launch the first manned interstellar mission. Ooh, cool. Now, this may sound like some form of sort of sci-fi fandom conference, but is actually being sponsored by NASA and DARPA to the tune of $100,000 and $1 million, respectively. DARPA, of course, is quite famous for creating some great scientific projects. They put forward the famous X Prizes, which resulted in the development of the first private spacecraft, the self-driving car, and they even sponsored something called the Shredder Challenge, which was a prize competition to explore methods for reconstructing shredded documents by a variety of shredding techniques.
That sounds like a security risk.
Yeah, well, actually, that was the whole point, is that either A, you know, if you take over someone's compound, like, I don't know, Bin Laden or Gaddafi or what have you, and of course they're shredding all the incriminating documents, can you go back and actually piece those documents together to find out what was originally there? And that was sort of the intent on it, which is not really a noble thing, but it was mathematically quite interesting. And for all those people who went and bought that high-tech shredder, seems like it's useless if DARPA really wants to find out.
I kind of actually find it a little bit funny that they're like going through the paper shredder wastebasket and trying to, like, wouldn't you just burn the documents? Like, isn't that more effective?
Yeah, no, well, see, but that has its own hindrance, because you kind of have to shred them first and then you'd want to burn them, because paper itself actually acts as a good insulator. So you have to like burn all the way through. Otherwise, the document sort of in the middle will be in pristine condition.
Interesting.
So, but actually it's quite ironic, is that some of the techniques that they use with the shredder thing was very similar to what they use with DNA, is that you kind of take little snippets and you piece them, you see where they kind of fit together, but you do it in a really macro sort of way. It was quite interesting. But we digress. The mission itself may seem sort of like a pie in the sky, and most of the participants accept this. However, even if the end game doesn't actually become achievable, there are possible for a great number of scientific discoveries that could be made in an attempt to achieve this sort of benefit to society. So even if we never actually build a rocket ship to go to Alpha Centauri, although I am certain we will, even in the trying to, you uncover a lot of different new technologies. The venture to the star will require the creation of revolutionary energy generation, storage and control systems, advanced propulsion systems, radical advancements in closed-loop life support systems, new insights into human development, health, behavior, training, as well as advances in robotics, automation, intelligence systems, manufacturing techniques. I mean, even things like, you know, establishing bases on the moon and in Mars and other parts of the solar system will be seen as part of sort of stepping stones for this. So even if we only accomplish those, I think it's far worth it to put this effort into it. Now, DARPA itself was created DARPA, I should just take a step back. DARPA is actually a part of the American military complex that's designed essentially for advanced intelligence sort of creation. It is the pie in the sky aspect of it. Forget what DARPA actually stands for off the top of my head. My apologies. But in the past, they've pursued far-fetched technology, and they've come up with things like the M16, the Saturn V rocket, and oh yes, you may have heard the internet. The pie in the sky can lead to some really interesting things. Now, some of the interesting things to come out of the recent 100-year Starship Symposium that I thought were interesting was one proposal for a rocketless ship. Now, you'd think if you were building a ship to go to a different solar system, it would be important for it to be a rocket. But apparently, one of the plans presented by Dr. Bradeen would pair a ship with a large asteroid or something like that. And as the asteroid sort of came by the sun, you would somehow change the orbit of the asteroid, so it actually reduced its orbit, so it actually went quickly around the sun. And in doing so, it would impart that energy to your quote-unquote ship, and it would go flying off towards the star, assuming you direct it the right way, at roughly about 1/10 of the light speed, which is kind of cool. And, I mean, who would have thought of that unless you were trying to do this sort of weird project? Some other designs are based on the use of nuclear energy to produce plasma streams. One line that actually kind of made me laugh, it basically said that, you know, we wouldn't really have to worry about radioactivity in space because space, well, it's already radioactive. Over 30 years ago, in another plan, the British Interplanetary Society proposed a fusion reactor. And this plan is being revised to see that, you know, in the 3 decades since they originally planned this, I believe it was Project Daedalus, you know, is it any more achievable now than it was then? Some other of the forums at the symposium dealt with boring things like, you know, how do you grow crops in space? Or how much toilet paper do you bring along with you for the ride? Of course, some of them said, you know, should we bring Bibles? Of course, you know, my opinion is that should be no, unless, of course, it was designed to solve the previous job. But after this sort of 1 year of this planning to plan a project, DARPA then plans to grant a $500,000 grant to an organization to sort of continue on with this planning process into the future, which I thought was quite interesting.
Well, $500,000, that's going to be like, what, 1.1% of the possible budget needed for a project like this?
Well, no, but remember what this particular project, it's they're not intending to build anything.
Right.
The whole point of this is to see, is it feasible? And what, you know, if you were going to take this seriously, what exactly would you need to do? What blocks are need to be put into place to do it? They're not saying, oh yes, let's see if we can start building the rocket now. But they're the step back and say, well, okay, what does that even mean to build a rocket to go into space? Because I mean, the current level of technology we have right now, we don't really have anything that's even remotely capable. You know, I mean, energy consumption, there are some theoretical ideas on the blueprint as far as humans living for that long. I mean, we talk about the idea of generational ships, but I mean, when you get down to the nuts and bolts, what would be required to create a generational ship to go to a planet like this? And that's what they're going into. Well, what are the nuts and bolts required as opposed to actually building the nuts and bolts?
I mean, well, that's an interesting thought experiment, and I guess it has to start somewhere. So, I mean, it seemed logical that, you know, putting some resources into, you know, thinking about this. The timetable is a bit iffy, in my opinion. The whole, I mean, yeah, like you mentioned, is it the 100 years project or is it a 100 years trip? Like that, I think, would matter. Because I think that if you're willing to spend, you know, a couple centuries in transit, that makes things a bit perhaps easier on the planning stage because you're not in a rush to get there. You're not trying to develop faster than light travel or something. But if you're trying to get there in a really quick way, that does sort of put the crunch on, you know, figuring out how to make anti-gravity, for example, and how to survive in space for that long. So, you know, it's a good starting point, but yeah. It does seem a bit, you know.
It is definitely pie in the sky.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no getting around that. But, I mean, it is like the first step. And I think, actually, the intent of this particular project itself is, I mean, $500,000, even if it's a pure research project, is we're talking years, maybe decade worth of funding, if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the idea is that, okay, so again, if we're going to get serious about this, you know, is 100 years enough? Could we do it in 50? Could we do it in 10? And when we actually send off the ship, you know, is it going to be 100 years? Is it going to be 200 years? Or can we do it in 10? You know, it's the first step, and okay, pie in the sky, but it's still kind of cool. And I like the idea that they're taking on a project not so much because, you know, it's the easy thing to do, but because it seems like the next step. I mean, we've often talked about we need to escape the ultimate death. I mean, this Earth is dead. There is a time limit. Humanity is definitely going to go extinct at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And until we learn to move off of the rock, we are condemned to that fate. So this is in one way an acknowledgement that, well, we should at some point start to think about this before we suddenly see the sun go supernova in our sky, which, of course, wouldn't happen, but it dramatic effect.
Sure, of course. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this. To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
Empower. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM. So, Don, we've talked about space and Star Wars. Now I think it's time that we discuss the Earth.
Well, you know, the big question that's on my mind is, does the Earth have Anthropocene?
I was about to ask you that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no, this isn't some build-up to a dirty joke. No, it's not something that I went to my doctor and found out that I may have to inform those people I've laid with recently that they should have themselves checked out. And no, it's not really about a story about an impending disaster that's about to envelop the Earth. Well, actually, maybe it is that last one. As people probably know, Earth's history is usually broken up into sort of time chunks. I mean, we often refer to a chronological clock, you know, that this happened 4 million years ago, 3 million years ago. That's sort of chronological. But another one is based upon sort of geological periods. Like, for example, there's the Permian period, which was ended based upon sort of a bunch of volcanism. So these are usually geological sort of chunks. Of course, they're not all geological. Some of them are based upon sort of climactic events. So the Pleistocene epoch is largely defined as sort of the classic glaciation period, global glaciation, or what we often call the Ice Age. Sometimes they're cosmic events that sort of create the like KT boundary, which is sort of when the dinosaurs ended and when the Cretaceous period ended. The current period or epoch that we live in is called the Holocene. That's Greek for entirely recent. Which strikes me as really kind of a bad name because, I mean, it can't always be entirely recent because at some point it's going to be entirely past, especially, you know, 1 million years in the future or something. But given that, scientists, though, are also sort of pushing for a new stage to sort of change things around called the Anthropocene, which is Greek for human new. Now, why the name change? Eugene Stromer originally coined the term in the 1980s, but it wasn't until Nobel Prize-winning scientist Paul Kurtz popularized it in the 2002 is when he did that. He's quoted as saying that, you know, I was at a conference where someone said something about the Holocene. I suddenly realized that this was wrong, that the world had changed too much. So I said, no, we're living in the Anthropocene. What Kurtzow and others believe distinguished this from the entirely recent form to the human new was the dramatic impact humanity has had on the planet in the most recent past centuries. By impact, we're talking about climate change, mass extinction, terraforming of continents, the complete rewiring of the world's hydrosphere, i.e., you know, waterworks and that sort of thing. Now, there is some controversy There is some controversy within the Anthropocene community as to what start date the human era would begin. Would it be something like, you know, some would want to push it back to like 15,000 years ago, where essentially it coincided with the big die-off of the megafauna, the woolly mammoths and stuff like that. Others would sort of half that date to the birth of agricultures. Others would bring it forward all the way up to the 1800s with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. I think, of course, personally, I would start with it about 3,000 years ago, plus or minus a millennium. This is when sort of human culture had developed enough to at least in local areas dramatically and, let's use the loaded term, unnaturally alter the biogeosphere of a significant area. Be it rerouting rivers for irrigation, the construction of man-made geological features, you know, pyramids, long walls, that sort of thing, or the desertification due to farming of large areas. Although controversial, it has become informally accepted in the scientific community. The Geological Society of America actually entitled their 2011 annual meeting, Archaea to Anthropocene, the past is the key to the future. So essentially, you know, there's this idea out there that, you know, does humans impact the world in a geologically important way. Now, again, in many regards, the scientific community has sort of accepted this, but it's still something that is controversial. I mean, one of the ironies about this is in a million years or so, anything that is identifiably human won't really exist anymore. You know, our buildings will disappear largely. There'll be some fossil evidence, but I mean, there won't actually be any mega intrusions that we think of in geological terms. I mean, we have no ice age equivalent to that. That being said, what we have done to things like the climate, through climate change, we have totally reworked the surface of the planet via agriculture, right? Now, are those superficial changes, or are those big enough to warrant an entire geological age? Which is where sort of the more serious controversy lies into it. Ethan, do you think humanity has geologically changed the planet that we deserve our own era, or are we still insignificant flies on the watermelon of Earth?
Interesting question. I mean, geologically, I think I have a hard time believing that we've had an impact on the planet. But, I mean, if we're talking about climate, which can affect the geography of the planet, geology of the planet, then certainly. And, you know, if we're talking about, say, for example, all our satellites in orbit, and suppose they all started to fall down or something, that could have an impact, I suppose. You know, if we had a nuclear war, we might be able to sink an island or two. So, I mean, I guess in certain circumstances, we could physically alter the very nature of the planet. That being said, I mean, if we all disappeared in about a million years, there wouldn't be too much evidence of us ever existing, aside from, you know, fossils and the occasional, you know, bronze statue that somehow survived. So that's a really hard thing to say. I mean, I think in terms of a superficial level, it's an absolutely apt term. In terms of a more universal term, I think there might be problems with it.
I think part of the issue we have is we don't know yet. I mean, for example, you have the KT event, right, when you had the massive asteroid slammed into the planet that coincided with the extinction of the dinosaurs, which was a major phylum of life on Earth. That seems to be a good point to put in, you know, a little break in the page and say, okay, the next chapter. You had the Permian, which I mentioned, which coincided with a bunch of lava flows, right? That's sort of believed to have caused another mass extinction. Quite often, periods will end with mass extinctions, which brings us into why they think this is one of the reasons why we can claim this. Above and beyond climate change, one of the side effects of climate change is mass extinction. The fact that we are overfishing is causing mass extinction. Because we are reworking the environment is causing mass extinction. So that in the same way that the asteroid caused mass extinction, we had other snowball Earth caused mass extinction, that we have elevated ourselves to this geological influence. But we really won't know the long-term effects until we are in the future, which is why it's kind of hard to know in the moment, is this really change or just the appearance of change?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could easily say, like, if we were to somehow, you know, shut down the oceanic conveyor belt and cause massive flooding, or, you know, that could easily swallow up land or cause, you know, water to recede, we could have an impact in that sense. But if, I mean, is that even going to be permanent, though? That's the thing, right? Like, it's not like we're going to, like, gouge a chunk of the Earth out like a big asteroid would. So it's really hard to say in that matter.
Well, but see, that's interesting. You do a good point. I mean, use the word permanence when really the whole essence of this is impermanence, right? I mean,
yeah.
Things change all the time. And, I mean, the meteorite that hit the Earth, well, we didn't know that it hit the Earth until we had to do quite a bit of digging. I mean, it wasn't like there was a, oh, look, there's the crater that killed off the dinosaurs. I mean, all evidence from that was pretty much wiped out. I mean, it was there, and if you looked hard enough, you could find it, but it was far from obvious.
Sure.
You know, and, well, but you're right. It will be interesting to see what impact we have. I think if we had, fortunately we didn't, a massive world nuclear war, I think that would be exactly equivalent to a KT event.
Yeah, me
but,
too.
You know, humans impacting the planet.
There's time still. There's time.
God wouldn't let that happen.
No, he wouldn't. Unless God caused it.
Yes.
Anyway, let's take a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. But
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
Ethan, sorry, can I get you to stand up against the wall? I think I saw you put something into your back pocket. I don't think you paid for that. I am the security guard here at CITR. Please, no, oh, stop resisting. Ethan, that. Okay, so this is made up. But there have been a number of stories in the local news lately regarding the role of security guards and loss prevention officers in our community. I thought it might be interesting to take a moment to look at sort of the legal status and implications for the public of some of the integral or tangential issues that revolve around this. So, first thing, what's a security guard? Well, put simply, they are citizens that have been granted a license. Not that the license gives them any actual special authority beyond that of being uniformed. You know, they look pretty, but they don't actually have any extra legal rights. The government does, though, get a nice dollar fee annually for the privilege of granting these licenses. They actually should be seen more as sort of a degree of knowledge, more than a sort of permission to kill. Well, if they were James Bond, I guess they would get that. So if you were going to go out and you were going to hire a guard, the fact that they were licensed would indicate to me as an employer that they had sort of a minimum training for the job. If I were a customer in the store, though, I should be aware that they may be keeping my eye on me. But beyond the social meme that we should respect a certain degree of authority, they're no different than any other citizen.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually had a friend who was a security guard for a time, and he told me that his job was basically he was getting paid to stand around and call the cops. Like, that was his job. And in fact, like, a lot of department stores, based on my experience, make you sign a form saying you will not interfere in a robbery, even if you are a security guard, because if you get, like, shot or stabbed or whatever, you could turn around and sue them.
Yeah, actually, and yeah. We'll go more into that, but you're right. I mean, they are essentially nothing other than just a normal person. Well, you know, I mean, they are sort of elevated to an employee. I mean, there are a certain degree that if someone from a shop told you, hey, stop, that would be different than some weirdo on the street saying, hey, stop.
They do have, some stores give them more freedom than that.
Well, but again, there's a difference between the legality versus the not. Because as I say, I may, if I wish to, if a security guard at Safeways yelled at me saying, stop, don't move or whatever, right? One, in my naivety, I might say, why? Is there a rock going to fall on my head or something, right? But again, if I was at the subway station or something and some guy with smelly clothes and a bottle of beer says, hey, stop, I might just hustle my pace up a little bit more.
Yeah.
So socially and you know, by convention, there is a difference. But in law, there really is no difference at all. And in fact, you might ask, how trained are they? And actually, they improved the training a lot when we had the Olympics here. But since the Olympics, really, all there is 40 hours, 1 week of training you get. At the end of that, you take a test, you pay your fees, and boom, a guard is born. They do cover some things, you know, like the law, how to fill out reports, sort of ethic and personal safety tips. Although, from what I understand, they're personal safety tips. You don't actually go through any personal safety training. So it's a very sort of minimalist thing they go through, and as I say, it's more of a way for employers to filter out people than it is for them to gain any special privileges in our society. In fact, one of the interesting things that have come up with some of the recent controversy is the fact that, you know, they don't do personality testing. So if you are a neo-Nazi intent on beating up the darky, they don't filter that out, so you still get to go through the whole thing. They don't actually give you training as to, well, how do you apprehend a person without injuring them and that sort of thing, right? So there's very much of a sort of a minimalist aspect to that.
Can I also add, it doesn't seem like they take much thought into who they hire either, because at my local grocery store, there's a security guard who's at least like 65, 70. I mean, seems like a very nice man, but I don't feel very much safer with him than I would say a burly young man who clearly is, you know, works out or something.
Well, again, and that's where you get the sort of weird dichotomy, is that on the one hand, they are often intended to be enforcement agents, although mm-hmm. they don't have any legal right really to do that. And on the other hand, they are, as you say, on the speed dial to the cops, and that's really all they're intended. In fact, most security guards in the Lower Mainland, from what I understand, are minimum wage jobs. I mean, they're not even well-paid jobs. So you right. sit there and you say, well, this person, quote, is putting their life at risk. Not that they are, but, you know, and you're paying them minimum wage, which is why you get a lot of inconsistency with how they react and who you see actually on the job. The legal status, as I say, is really equivalent to a citizen, although some are licensed to use, you know, dogs. Some can be used restraining equipment like handcuffs. So there are certain degrees of what you're allowed to use and what you're authorized to use. But none of the licenses include things like energy weapons, which is my fancy way of saying like tasers or guns. That purview is still strictly limited to law enforcement officers who do have these superpowers. So you might ask then, well, what is a citizen's arrest? Because essentially if they're citizens and they try to apprehend you, it is a citizen's arrest. It's the same thing that if I was trying to do it or if the guy in the yellow jacket were trying to do it. Well, according to the law, you can step in to prevent a crime in progress or if you believe on, quote, reasonable grounds, someone has committed a criminal offense and is escaping from and freshly pursued by those of a lawful authority. So essentially, if someone is actually performing a crime, and I think in this particular case, if it was more like a violent, if I was sitting there, I was smashing in a window or something, I could just jump them and restrain them from breaking the window.
Well, or sort of the common example, somebody nabs an old lady's purse and you or I could tackle them on the street until a cop shows up.
And that actually blends into the second part, because again, you have to believe on reasonable grounds that that wasn't their purse they were taking.
Right.
I mean, which, you know, would seem obvious. But it can get very, very fuzzy when, you know, like, what does reasonable grounds really mean? And there is actually no real firm definition. Ironically enough, the court does implicitly define it as in that if you were sued for false arrest, you could prove that it was reasonable that you arrested them. And there's a certain degree of circular logic going on there. But so if most of the security companies and retail loss preventions actually do provide sort of a rule of thumb that unless you actually see someone take a product that you know is store property and you know that it's unpaid for, and that person has either left the store or is on the verge of leaving the store. So, I mean, most stores have a very high threshold as to what qualifies. Then, of course, you can step in and try and forcefully restrict them. And then, of course, what level of force are you allowed to use? Most companies will emphasize the idea of minimal force, right? Because they're wanting to protect their employees both for ethical reasons and for legal reasons. But in a case and where a lot of these issues that have come up recently in the area of a mall, it becomes much more fuzzier. Because, I mean, in a store, there's sort of a defined threshold, but a mall is a much more larger area to deal with. So at what point have they left the premises? I mean, is it once they've left the store and they're still in the mall, where does that sort of delineate? And that's where you get some of the very interesting cases occurring. Another note is that the incidences of inappropriate behavior and excessive violence on the part of security guards and even proper law officers has basically come to light largely because they can be recorded, i.e. with cell phone cameras. And that's one of the other sort of side notes on this. But first of all, before we go down that road, Ethan, mm-hmm. what do you think? Okay, so I think we kind of agree that, you know, a big box store like, say, Safeways or Canadian Tire that have their internal security guards are pretty delineated. But when you deal with mall security, which essentially are the same people, But they tend to have this sort of super cop attitude sometimes about them. Not all of them. But in the most recent cases that I've read about was the takedown of the guy in the wheelchair, right? Who probably, maybe not, you know, presumption of innocence, was stealing some sunglasses. I believe that was it. But, I mean, there was no, from what we saw, there was no violence on the part of the guy trying to get away, right? He was in a wheelchair, a motorized wheelchair, but, I mean, he was obeying what was asked for. But the security guard just started yelling at him and swearing at him and then knocked him out of the chair onto the ground. I mean, that seems to be the extreme other end. So at what point do you say, well, I'm not sure he stole it, let him go, and hey, you bastard, smack, smack.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a difficult question because, as you say, there doesn't seem to be any kind of law in place that clearly, you know, delineates where the authority of the security guard begins and ends. Because if we're talking about a mall, for example, like say you have a Future Shop or something in the mall, does the ability of the security guard begin and end at the entrance of the store within the mall, or does it include the entire mall? And if so, is that only for mall security, or is that also for Future Shop security, or are they one and the same? So that's a tricky question. I mean, I think we can always agree that, you know, using excessive force, probably regardless of whether it's law enforcement or mall security, is probably uncalled for, especially if the person you're arresting is disabled. I think we can agree that's kind of overkill. I mean, if the guy is, like, you know, tossing a gun around, okay, fine. Maybe you have reasonable cause. But it seems a little extreme if somebody's, you know, stolen a couple of sunglasses.
Well, and there's also another issue that comes up with this because, I mean, we need to parse this rather carefully because obviously, I mean, shoplifting is quite prevalent in our society, has been forever. And, you know, there is a certain right that stores and that have in order to protect their property. And you have to be careful about that. But at the same time, if you are a teenage person going down the mall and the security guard says, hey, you, stop. I mean, at what point do you have a certain degree of personal autonomy not to be harassed by that, you know? And how much do they get to search you before it becomes, again, inappropriate? Is it just because they're whim? Do they need to provide, you know, some sort of probable cause? I mean, one of the things that came out of one of the incidences is that there is no legal requirement, I believe, for security guards to make a report about incidences themselves. So you can't even really go back and trace it. I mean, most stores will have some informal method of doing that, but there is no actual formal or legal requirement for them to make a list that, hey, I roughed up this, well, sorry, I used force to detain this particular individual, and just a record of that, so you can go back and see, well, is there sort of a habit or a record? And the fact that security guards in particular and loss prevention officers in general sort of fall into this quasi semi-legal, semi-authoritarian space that I think in a way, you know, leads me to worry to a certain degree about my own autonomy and safety just because I don't like Big Brother. I think, you know, that's quite easy for some people in positions of authorities to abuse them. But at the same time, that needs to be balanced with a society where shit happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess the safest option would always be to, if you encounter someone you think is stolen something, you really need to have the police on speed dial because I think they're really the only people who have the authority to, you know, seize and search. So, I mean, you either have to be very fast with your cell phone or, you know, find some other, you know, non-violent way of confronting the person, which I think is probably part and parcel of being a security guard.
True. You'd think it would be.
Yeah.
And actually, there was one other issue that came out of this, a little tangential, but I think very interesting. One of the stories was about an aspiring journalist high schooler who was actually using film, you know, the old click-click onto plasticky sort of stuff, where he took a couple of pictures of security guards and responding RCMP officers, quote, taking down a suspect in a rather forceful or violent manner. The teen was then tackled, roughed up, cuffed, and had, ironically, his own property damaged for the crime of taking the picture himself. The security guards, who were largely responsible, not so much the RCMP, because they weren't quite aware of the facts on the ground, I think, but the security guards were somehow thought it was illegal or thought it was offensive that someone was taking a picture of them while they were performing this potential crime or this potential act of enforcement, however you look at it. Now, of course, one of the things that's important for people to know, that legally, anyone actually has the right to take a picture of anyone in a public place, period. So if it's in a public place, no matter what you're doing, you're allowed to take pictures, and no one has the right to walk up to you, be it a cop, be it a security guard, or your Uncle Fred, saying you have to delete that or you have to get rid of that. But what makes this sort of chilling to me is that the incident with the teen raises a bigger question that I've read about quite a bit that's happened south of the border. In a number of jurisdictions, it's actually become a crime to videotape or record or even take pictures of law enforcement officers doing their job. So there have been people who've been arrested, thrown in jail, because they were taking videotape of the cops arresting someone for drunk driving or something like that. And in a number of these cases, to be fair, it wasn't very flattering for the arresting officers. You know, racial slurs were being thrown around. There was at least the visible perception of excessive violence being used. There is a lot of sort of ethnic profiling going on. And the fact that they would make it illegal for citizens to videotape these sort of incidences just struck me as chilling. Because, I mean, one of the things that we require as a society to operate is a free flow of information. I mean, if we cannot watch the people who are watching us, the security people, a lot of wrongdoing can go on.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, raises more questions, especially with the recent, you know, Occupy movement as well. To what extent are you allowed to film law enforcement, especially when law enforcement is doing something that, you know, is potentially illegal? So it's a difficult question.
It is. And again, it's so funny how many, a lot of these ethical arguments fall in, I don't know, irony or paradox, because the same people who are sitting there and demanding that I should be able to videotape at my leisure police officers doing their job are the same people who turn around and complain when the police go to a rally and are taking photos of people at the rally, or they have the CCD cameras. Now, I don't think they're quite equivalent. I think the fact that a law enforcement person is a subject of the state and he's, while he's doing his job, is a representative of my government, therefore I have a right to film him, is slightly different than the officer filming me at a protest or what have you. But, I mean, there is an interesting dichotomy. And just recently we had a law passed, I believe, that made it illegal for you to go to a protest and wear a mask, that you have to have your face visible at all times, and partly because the officers are there recording, and they feel that, you know, if they know who's there, it's easier for them later to come back and arrest you for things. I mean, we had the fiasco, I can call it a fiasco, of the Vancouver riots, right? Where, you know, people with their cell phones on that, taken out of context, were arrested, were charged with crimes they may or may not have committed. There were a number of people, of course, who got away with crimes that they should have been arrested for. I mean, I'm not saying that the riots were a good thing and that there wasn't proper to try and enforce it. But there seems to be a lack of systematic thought with regards to who should we record, how should we record it, and what responsibilities go with. And based on what I've seen in the United States, this is an opportunity for us here in Canada to get sort of ahead of the curve, that these issues are going to come up here. They are beginning to show up here. And if we do a proactive sort of analysis of what's in everyone's best interest, we won't have the same kind of weirdness and perhaps illegalities going on in the States.
Yeah. I mean, I think also part of the problem is that there really doesn't seem to be any kind of proper understanding of the role of social media in law enforcement. I mean, you know, you look at sort of Twitter and all, I mean, it's a fairly new technology, relatively speaking. So, I mean, there's no precedent really for including social media in how we document crime. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of research going into how it impacts things, how law enforcement uses it, and how the public uses it, interacting with law enforcement. And if there is any research being done on it, I'm not really sure that it's being taken very seriously, because the results of local stories that we hear seems to be people just kind of putting their fingers in their ears going, la, 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 I'm not going to pretend Twitter exists, and just trying to shut it down, which I think is sort of the kind of opposite reaction, that you would rather have law enforcement spend time looking at this and saying, okay, how can we do our job in the world that exists with Twitter and Instagram and all these other things, right?
Well, and there also, there's the whole idea of what constitutes areas of evidence, right? I mean, there was a kid in England who was arrested for Facebook, and I think there's another one for Twitter. The Facebook was to provoke a riot because he says, hey, everyone, we should all gather here and do a protest against austerity measures, and he was arrested for provoking a riot. Another one had said something which I guess was not very nice, but was charged with a hate crime because he tweeted that so-and-so should die. And don't get me wrong, that's not a good thing to say. But we have this whole new technology where we need to sort of test the boundaries of what's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And like, as you point out, you know, to pretend it doesn't exist, A, handicaps the police on the one hand, and two, leaves people vulnerable to be accused of things that are criminal, but criminal in such a new way that you wouldn't necessarily know that they were criminal.
Yeah. It definitely is something that, you know, I think as skeptics, we may be able to have a tangible impact on this by discussing this more and trying to promote it in sort of academic institutions as well to try to get the ball rolling on social change.
Yes. Yes, we could. Mm. And I guess on that note, we're heading to the end of the show.
Yeah, we should go on to our skeptical highlights. So mine is an upcoming event. It's for the CFI Book Club. And this week, it's the Canon, the Wurgling Tour of the Beautiful Basics of Science by Natalie Unger. And this is happening on Saturday, November 10th at 1 p.m. at the Grind and Galley Coffee Bar on Main Street. So check that out. Should be lots of fun. Don, what do you have for us?
I got a cough. Wow. What good timing. So actually I have two highlights, sort of. One not really, but you'll understand why in a second. The first one is like really, really cool. It's an app or a service that you can subscribe to called Spot the Station. NASA apparently has launched this new thing where it will send you an email alert whenever the International Space Station is flying over your head. So you can rush out and you can take your binoculars or your eyes, because I think it's visible from with the human eye. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of wave to the astronauts as they go overhead. Of course, the American military has warned that actually maybe this isn't such a good idea because they're afraid that terrorists may use this information to prompt a plane attack onto the space station. Obviously not understanding the aerodynamics involved in this, but Homeland Security are crazy anyhow.
Yeah.
The other highlight I have is, as well as everyone knows, is today is the American election. And, of course, who wins the election is one interesting thing. But there's been one interesting note that's come out, and I haven't talked about it show because it's really kind of an American nerdy thing, but some people who listen to the show may find it interesting, is in the United States election, there's this big idea of what they call voter suppression. So it works in sort of two ways. One, in the United States, unlike in Canada, you're not automatically registered to vote when you fill out your income tax. You have to go fill out a form and register yourself to vote. And there's been a lot of attempts to make that so difficult for people that thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have not voted. For example, one stat had in Florida up to September, in the 2004 and 2008 elections, they had registered something like 200,000 people in this sort of election lead up. But because they had changed the laws and they had made it a criminal offense with tens of thousands of dollars of fines, that only 20,000 people had been registered at that point. And these disproportionately for one party versus another. They also have the idea of voter ID laws, where you have to present photo ID that is of an appropriate kind so that you can actually vote. And in those particular areas, again, disproportionately affects one demographic over another. In fact, you had some things where you had the governor of Pennsylvania saying, we've enacted these voter ID laws, therefore guaranteeing the state for Mitt Romney, which made it sound quite dubious. So where I'm finding an interesting thing isn't so much as to who wins or loses this election, but to take a skeptical look as to, well, they've made these claims that, you know, this voter suppression is going to be a big thing in this election. Is it actually going to turn out to be true, or was it just more political hype? So those, you know, wonks out there in politics, take note of the voter demographics, the voter turnout in particular states, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which are all sort of the hotbed ones where this is supposed to have been a major factor, and see if it turns out. It'll add an extra sort of spin to what will already be a quite exciting election.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the star.